How'd you do, and how'd you do again?
Reynolds said nothing. He often didn't understand Jonas, but he had been riding with him since the age of 15, and knew it was usually better not to ask for enlightenment. If you did, you were apt to end up listening to a cult Manny lecture about the other worlds the old buzzard had visited through what he called the special doors. As far as Reynolds was concerned, there were enough ordinary doors in the world to keep him busy.
"I'll speak to Reimer, and Reimer'll talk to the sheriff about where they should stay," Jonas said. "I think the bunkhouse at the old Bar K Ranch, you know where I mean?"
Reynolds did. In a barony like Magus, you got to know the few landmarks in a hurry. The Bar K was a deserted spread of land northwest of town, not too far from that weird, squalling canyon. They burned at the mouth of the canyon every fall, and once, 6 or 7 years ago, the wind had shifted and gone back wrong, and burned most of the Bar K to the ground, barns, stables, the home place. It had spared the bunkhouse, however, and that would be a good spot for 3 tenderfeet from the innards. It was away from the drop. It was also away from the oil patch.
"You like it, don't you?"
Jonas asked, putting on a hick Hambry accent.
"Ah, ye like it very much, I can see ye do, McCully. You know what they say in Cressia? If ye'd steal the silver from the dining room, first put the dog in the pantry."
Reynolds nodded. It was good advice. "And those trucks, those, what do you call 'em, tankers?"
"Fine where they are," Jonas said. "Not that we could move 'em now without attracting the wrong kind of attention, eh? You and Roy want to go out there and cover 'em with brush, lay it on nice and thick. Day after tomorrow you'll do it."
"And where will you be while we're flexing our muscles out at Sitco?"
"By daylight? Preparing for dinner at Mayor's house, you clod. The dinner Thorin will be giving to introduce his guests from the great world to the shit-picky society of the smaller one."
Jonas began making another cigarette. He gazed up at the romp rather than at what he was doing and still spilled barely a scrap of tobacco.
"A bath, a shave, a trim of these tangled old man's locks? I might even wax my mustache, Clay. What do you say to that?"
"Don't strain yourself, Eldred." Jonas laughed, the sound shrill enough to make Barky mutter and Petty stir uneasily on her makeshift bar-top bed.
"So Roy and I aren't invited to this fancy do?"
"You'll be invited, oh yes, you'll be invited very warmly," Jonas said, and handed Reynolds the fresh cigarette.
He began making another for himself.
"I'll offer your excuses. I'll do you boys proud. Count on me. Strong men may weep.
Also, we can spend the day out there in the dust and stink covering those hulks. You're too kind, Jonas."
"I'll be asking questions as well," Jonas said dreamily, "drifting here and there, looking spruce, smelling of bayberries, and asking my little questions. I've known folks in our line of trade who'll go to a fat, jolly fella to find out the gossip, a saloon keeper or a bartender, perhaps a livery stable owner or one of the chubby fellas who always hangs about the jail or the courthouse with his thumbs tucked into his vest pockets. As for myself, Clay, I find that a woman's best, and the narrower the better, one with more nose than tits sticking off her. I look for one who don't paint her lips and keeps her hair scooped back against her head."
"You have someone in mind?"
"Yeah. Cordelia Delgado's her name."
"Delgado?"
"You know the name. It's on the lips of everyone in this town, I reckon. Susan Delgado, our esteemed mayor's soon-to-be Jilly, Cordelia's her auntie. Now, here's a fact of human nature I've found. Folk are more apt to talk to someone like her who plays them close than they are to the local jolly types who'll buy you a drink. And that lady plays them close. I'm going to slip in next to her at that dinner, and I'm going to compliment her on the perfume I doubt like hell she'll be wearing, and I'm going to keep a wine glass full. Now, how sounds that for a plan?"
"A plan for what? That's what I want to know."
"For the game of castles we may have to play," Jonas said, and all the lightness dropped out of his voice. "We're to believe that these boys have been sent here more as a punishment than to do any real job of work. It sounds plausible, too. I've known rakes in my time, and it sounds plausible indeed. I believe it each day until about 3 in the morning, and then a little doubt sets in. And do you know what, Clay?
Reynolds shook his head.
I'm right to doubt. Just as I was right to go with Rhymer to old man Thorin and convince him that Farson's glass would be better with the witch woman for the nonce. She'll keep it in a place where a gunslinger couldn't find it, let alone a nosy lad who's yet to have his first piece of ass. These are strange times. A storm's coming. And when you know the wind is going to blow, it's best to keep your gear battened down.
He looked at the cigarette he had made. He had been dancing it along the backs of his knuckles, as Reynolds had done earlier. Jonas pushed back the fall of his hair and tucked the cigarette behind his ear.
"I don't want to smoke," he said, standing up and stretching. His back made small crackling sounds. "I'm crazy to smoke at this hour of the morning. Too many cigarettes apt to keep an old man like me awake."
He walked toward the stairs, squeezing Petty's bare leg as he went by, also as Reynolds had done. At the foot of the stairs, he looked back.
"I don't want to kill them. Things are delicate enough without that. I'll smell quite a little wrong on them and not lift a finger, no, not a single finger, my hand. But I'd like to make them clear on their place in the great scheme of things."
"Give them a sore paw." Jonas brightened.
"Yes, sir, partner. Maybe a sore paw's just what I'd like to give 'em. Make 'em think twice about tangling with the big coffin hunters later on, when it matters. Make them swing wide around us when they see us in their road. Yes, sir, that's something to think about. It really is."
He started up the stairs, chuckling a little, his limp quite pronounced. It got worse late at night. It was a limp Roland's old teacher, Court, might have recognized. For Court had seen the blow which caused it. Court's own father had dealt it with an ironwood club, breaking Eldred Jonas's leg in the yard behind the great hall of Gilead, before taking the boy's weapon and sending him west, gunless, into exile. Eventually, the man the boy had become had found a gun, of course. The exiles always did, if they looked hard enough. That such guns could never be quite the same as the big ones with the sandalwood grips might haunt them for the rest of their lives, but those who needed guns could still find them, even in this world. Reynolds watched until he was gone, then took his seat at Coral Thorin's desk, shuffled the cards, and continued the game which Jonas had left half-finished. Outside, the sun was coming up. Chapter 5. Welcome to Town. 1. 2 nights after arriving in the barony of Magus, Roland, Cuthbert, and Alain rode their mounts beneath an adobe arch with the words, "Come in Peace," inscribed above it. Beyond was a cobblestone courtyard lit with torches. The resin which coated these had been doctored somehow, so that the torches glowed different colors, green, orangey-red, a kind of sputtery pink that made Roland think of fireworks. He could hear the sound of guitars, the murmur of voices, the laughter of women. The air was redolent of those smells which would always remind him of Magus, sea salt, oil, and pine.
"I don't know if I can do this," Alain muttered.
He was a big boy, with a mop of unruly blonde hair spilling out from under his stockman's hat. He had cleaned up well, they all had, but Alain, no social butterfly under the best of circumstances, looked scared to death. Cuthbert was doing better, but Roland guessed his old friend's patina of insouciance didn't go very deep. If there was to be leading done here, he would have to do it.
"You'll be fine," he told Alain.
"Just, oh, he looks fine," Cuthbert said, with a nervous laugh, as they crossed the courtyard. Beyond it was Mayor's house, a sprawling, many-winged adobe hacienda that seemed to spill light and laughter from every window. "White as a sheet, ugly as a shut-up," Roland said curtly, and the teasing smile tumbled off Cuthbert's face at once. Roland noted this, then turned to Alain again. "Just don't drink anything with alcohol in it. You know what to say on that account. Remember the rest of our story, too. Smile, be pleasant, use what social graces you have. Remember how the sheriff fell all over himself to make us feel welcome." Alain nodded at that, looking a little more confident. In the matter of social graces, Cuthbert said, they won't have many themselves, so we should all be a step ahead. Roland nodded, then saw that the bird's skull was back on the horn of Cuthbert's saddle, and get rid of that. Looking guilty, Cuthbert stuffed the lookout hurriedly into his saddlebag. Two men, wearing white jackets, white pants, and sandals, were coming forward, bowing and smiling. "Keep your heads," Roland said, lowering his voice. "Both of you remember why you're here, and remember the faces of your fathers." He clapped a lan, who still looked doubtful, on the shoulder. Then he turned to the hostlers. "Good even, gents," he said. "May your days be long upon the earth." They both grinned, their teeth flashing in the extravagant torchlight. The older one bowed. "And your own as well, young masters. Welcome to Mayor's House." Two. The High Sheriff had welcomed them the day before every bit as happily as the hostlers. So far, everyone had greeted them happily, even the carters they had passed on their way into town. And that alone made Roland feel suspicious and on his guard. He told himself he was likely being foolish. Of course the locals were friendly and helpful. That was why they had been sent here, because Magus was both out of the way and loyal to the affiliation. And it probably was foolish. But he thought it best to be on close watch just the same. To be a trifle nervous. The three of them were little more than children, after all, and if they fell into trouble here, it was apt to be as a result of taking things at face value. The combined sheriff's office and jail of Barony was on Hill Street, overlooking the bay. Roland didn't know for sure, but guessed that few, if any, hungover drunks and wife-beaters anywhere else in Midworld woke up to such picturesque views. A line of many-colored boathouses to the south, the docks directly below, with boys and old men line-fishing while the women mended nets and sails. Beyond them, Hambry's small fleet moving back and forth on the sparkling blue water of the bay, setting their nets in the morning, pulling them in the afternoon. Most buildings on the high street were adobe. But up here, overlooking Hambry's business section, they were as squat and bricky as any narrow lane in Gilead's old quarter. Well kept, too, with wrought-iron gates in front of most and tree-shaded paths. The roofs were orange tile, the shutters closed against the summer sun. It was hard to believe, riding down this street with their horses' hoofs clocking on the swept cobbles, that the northwestern side of the affiliation, the ancient land of Eld, Arthur's kingdom, could be on fire and in danger of falling. The jailhouse was just a larger version of the post office and land office, a smaller version of the town gathering hall. Except, of course, for the bars on the windows facing down toward the small harbor. Sheriff Herc Avery was a big-bellied man in a lawman's khaki pants and shirt. He must have been watching them approach through the spy hole in the center of the jail's iron-banded front door, because the door was thrown open before Roland could even reach for the turnbell in the center. Sheriff Avery appeared on the stoop, his belly preceding him as a bailiff may precede my lord judge into court. His arms were thrown wide in the most amiable of greetings. He bowed deeply to them. Cuthbert said later he was afraid the man might overbalance and go rolling down the steps, perhaps go rolling all the way down to the harbor, and wished them repeated good morns, tapping away at the base of his throat like a madman the whole while. His smile was so wide it looked as if it might cut his head clean in two. Three deputies with a distinctly farmerish look about them, dressed in khaki like the sheriff, crowded into the door behind Avery and gawked. That was what it was, all right, a gawk. There was just no other word for that sort of openly curious and totally unself-conscious stare. Avery shook each boy by the hand, continuing to bow as he did so, and nothing Roland said could get him to stop until he was done. When he finally was, he showed them inside. The office was delightfully cool in spite of the beating midsummer sun. That was the advantage of brick, of course. It was big as well, and cleaner than any high sheriff's office Roland had ever been in before. and he had been in at least half a dozen over the last 3 years, accompanying his father on several short trips and one longer patrol swing. There was a roll-top desk in the center, a notice board to the right of the door, the same sheets of foolscap had been scribbled on over and over, paper was a rare commodity in Midworld, and in the far corner, two rifles in a padlocked case. These were such ancient blunderbusses that Roland wondered if there was ammunition for them. He wondered if they would fire, come to that. To the left of the gun case, an open door gave on the jail itself, three cells on each side of a short corridor, and a smell of strong lye soap drifting out. "They've cleaned for our coming," Roland thought. He was amused, touched, and uneasy. Cleaned it as though we were a troop of inner barony horse, career soldiers who might want to stage a hard inspection instead of three lads serving punishment detail. But was such nervous care on the part of their hosts really so strange? They were from New Canaan, after all, and folk in this tucked-away corner of the world might well see them as a species of visiting royalty. Sheriff Avery introduced his deputies. Roland shook hands with all of them, not trying to memorize their names. It was Cuthbert who took care of names, and it was a rare occasion when he dropped one. The third, a bald fellow with a monocle hanging around his neck on a ribbon, actually dropped to one knee before them.
"Don't do that, you great idiot!" Avery cried, yanking him back up by the scruff of his neck. "What kind of a bumpkin will they think you? Besides, you've embarrassed them, so you have."
"That's all right," Roland said. He was, in fact, very embarrassed, although trying not to show it. "We're really nothing at all special, you know."
"Nothing special," Avery said, laughing.
His belly, Roland noticed, did not shake as one might have expected it to do. It was harder than it looked. The same might be true of its owner.
"Nothing special," he says. 500 mile or more from the in-world they've come. Our first official visitors from the affiliation since a gunslinger passed through on the Great Road 4 years ago, and yet he says they're nothing special. Would you sit, my boys? I've got graph, which you won't want so early in the day. Perhaps not at all, given your ages. And if you'll forgive me for stating so bald the obvious fact of your youth, for youth's not a thing to be ashamed of, so it's not. We were all young once. And I also have white iced tea, which I recommend most hearty, as Dave's wife makes it, and she's a dab hand with most any potable.
Roland looked at Cuthbert and Alan, who nodded and smiled and tried not to look all at sea. Then back at Sheriff Avery. White tea would go down a treat in a dusty throat, he said. One of the deputies went to fetch it. Chairs were produced and set in a row at one side of Sheriff Avery's roll-top, and the business of the day commenced.
"You know who you are and where you hail from, and I know the same," Sheriff Avery said, sitting down in his own chair. It uttered a feeble groan beneath his bulk, but held steady. "I can hear in-world in your voices, but more important, I can see it in your faces. Yet we hold to the old ways here in Hambry, sleepy and rural as we may be, we hold to our course and remember the faces of our fathers as well as we can. So although I'd not keep you long from your duties, and if you'll forgive me for the impertinence, I'd like a look at any papers and documents of passage you might just happen to have brought into town with you."
They just happened to have brought all of their papers into town with them, as Roland was sure Sheriff Avery well knew they would. He went through them quite slowly for a man who'd promised not to hold them from their duties, tracing the well-folded sheets, the linen content so high that the documents were perhaps closer to cloth than paper, with one pudgy finger, his lips moving. Every now and then the finger would reverse as he reread a line. The two other deputies stood behind him, looking sagely down over his large shoulders. Roland wondered if either could actually read. William Dearborn, drover's son. Richard Stockworth, rancher's son. Arthur Heath, stockline breeder's son. The identification document belonging to each was signed by an attester, James Reed of Hemphill in the case of Dearborn, Pete Ravenhead of Pendleton in the case of Stockworth, Lucas Rivers of Gilead in the case of Heath. All in order, descriptions nicely matched. The papers were handed back with profuse thanks. Roland next handed Avery a letter, which he took from his wallet with some care. Avery handled it in the same fashion. his eyes growing wide as he saw the Frank at the bottom.
"'Pon my soul, boys, 'twas a gunslinger wrote this.'
"'Aye, so it was,' Cuthbert agreed in a voice of wonder. Roland kicked his ankle hard without taking his respectful eyes from Avery's face. The letter above the Frank was from one Stephen Deshane of Gilead, a gunslinger, which was to say a knight, squire, peacemaker, and baron, the last title having almost no meaning in the modern day, despite all John Farson's ranting, of the 29th generation descended from Arthur of Eld on the sideline of descent, the long-descended get of one of Arthur's many gillies, in other words. To Mayor Hartwell Thorin, Chancellor Kimba Rymer, and High Sheriff Herkimer Avery, it sent greetings and recommended to their notice the three young men who delivered this document, Masters Dearborn, Stockworth, and Heath. These had been sent on special mission from the affiliation to serve as counters of all materials which might serve the affiliation in time of need. The word war was omitted from the document, but glowed between every line. Stephen Deshane, on behalf of the affiliation of baronies, exhorted Misters Thorin, Rymer, and Avery to afford the affiliation's nominated counters every help in their service, and to be particularly careful in the enumerations of all livestock, all supplies of food, and all forms of transport. Dearborn, Stockworth, and Heath would be in Magus for at least 3 months, Deshane wrote, possibly as long as a year. The document finished by inviting any or all of the addressed public officials to write us word of these young men and their deportment in all detail as you shall imagine of interest to us. And, it begged, do not stint in this matter if you love us. Tell us if they behave themselves, in other words. Tell us if they've learned their lesson. The deputy with the monocle came back while the High Sheriff was perusing this document. He carried a tray loaded with 4 glasses of white tea and bent down with it like a butler. Roland murmured thanks and handed the glasses around. He took the last for himself, raised it to his lips, and saw Alain looking at him, his blue eyes bright in his stolid face. Alain shook his glass slightly, just enough to make the ice tinkle, and Roland responded with the barest sliver of a nod. He had expected cool tea from a jug kept in a nearby springhouse, but there were actual chunks of ice in the glasses. Ice in high summer. It was interesting. And the tea was, as promised, delicious. Avery finished the letter and handed it back to Roland with the air of one passing on a holy relic.
"'You want to keep that safe about your person, Will Dearborn? Aye, very safe indeed.'
"'Yes, sir.' He tucked the letter and his identification back into his purse. His friends Richard and Arthur were doing the same. "'This is excellent white tea, sir,' Alain said. "'I've never had better.'
"'Aye,' Avery said, sipping from his own glass. "'Tis the honey that makes it so fearsome, eh, Dave?'
The deputy with the monocle smiled from his place by the notice board.
"'I believe so, but Judy don't like to say. She had the recipe from her mother.' "'Aye, we must remember the faces of our mothers, too, so we must.'
Sheriff Avery looked sentimental for a moment, but Roland had an idea that the face of his mother was the furthest thing from the big man's mind just then. He turned to Alain, and sentiment was replaced by a surprising shrewdness.
"'You're wondering about the ice, Master Stockworth.'
Alain started.
"'Well, he expected no such amenity in a backwater like Hambry, I'll warrant,'
Avery said, and although there was a joshing quality on top of his voice, Roland thought there was something else entirely underneath. "'He doesn't like us. He doesn't like what he thinks of as our city ways.' He hasn't known us long enough to know what kind of ways we have, if any at all, but already he doesn't like them. He thinks we're a trio of snot-noses, that we see him and everyone else here as country bumpkins. "'Not just Hambry,' Alain said quietly. "'Ice is as rare in the inner arc these days as anywhere else, Sheriff Avery. When I grew up, I saw it mostly as a special treat at birthday parties and such. "'There was always ice on glowing day,' Cuthbert put in. He spoke with very un-Cuthbertian quiet. Except for the fireworks, that's what we liked about it most.
"'Is that so? Is that so?
Sheriff Avery said, in an amazed, wonders-will-never-cease tone. Avery perhaps didn't like them riding in like this. Didn't like having to take up what he would probably call half the damn morning with them. He didn't like their clothes, their fancy identification papers, their accents, or their youth. Least of all, their youth. Roland could understand all that, but wondered if it was the whole story. If there was something else going on here, what was it?
"There's a gas-fired refrigerator and stove in the town gathering hall," Avery said. "Both work. There's plenty of earth gas out at Sitgo. That's the oil patch east of town. You're past it on your way in, I wot."
They nodded.
"Stove's not but a curiosity these days, a history lesson for the schoolchildren. But the refrigerator comes in handy, so it does."
Avery held up his glass and looked through the side.
"Especially in summer."
He sipped some tea, smacked his lips, and smiled at Alain.
"You see? No mystery."
"I'm surprised you haven't found use for the oil," Roland said. "No generators in town, Sheriff?"
"Aye, there be four or five," Avery said. "The biggest is out at Francis Langill's Rocking Bee Ranch, and I recall when it used to run. It's Honda. Do you ken it, that name, boys, Honda?"
"I've seen it once or twice," Roland said, "on old motor-driven bicycles."
"Aye? In any case, none of the generators will run on the oil from the Sitgo patch. 'Tis too thick. Tarry goo is all. We have no refineries here."
"I see," Alain said. "In any case, ice in summer is a treat, however it comes to the glass." He let one of the chunks slip into his mouth and crunched it between his teeth. Avery looked at him a moment longer, as if to make sure the subject was closed, then switched his gaze back to Roland. His fat face was once more radiant with his broad, untrustworthy smile.
"Mayor Thorin has asked me to extend ye his very best greetings and convey his regrets for not being here today. Very busy is our Lord Mayor, very busy indeed. But he's laid on a dinner party at Mayor's house tomorrow evening. 7 o'clock for most folk, 8 for you young fellas. So you can make a bit of an entrance, I imagine, at a touch of drama-like. And I need not tell such as yourselves, who've probably attended more such parties than I've had hot dinners, that it would be best to arrive pretty much on the dot."
"Is it fancy dress?" Cuthbert asked uneasily. "Because we've come a long way, almost 400 wheels, and we didn't pack formal wear and sashes, none of us." Avery was chuckling. More honestly this time, Roland thought, perhaps because he felt Arthur had displayed a streak of unsophistication and insecurity.
"Nay, young master, Thorin understands ye've come to do a job. Next door to working cowboys ye be. Where they don't have ye out dragging nets in the bay next."
From the corner, Dave, the deputy with the monocle, honked unexpected laughter. Perhaps it was the sort of joke you had to be local to understand, Roland thought.
"Wear the best ye have and ye'll be fine. There'll be no one there in sashes. In any case, that's not how things are done in Hambry."
Again Roland was struck by the man's constant smiling denigration of his town and barony, and the resentment of the outsiders which lay just beneath it.
"In any case, ye'll find yourselves working more than playing tomorrow night, I imagine. Hart's invited all the large ranchers, stockliners, and livestock owners from this part of the barony. Not that there's so many, you understand, being as how Magus is next door to desert once you get west of the drop. But everyone whose goods and chattel you've been sent to count will be there. And I think you'll find all of them loyal affiliation men, ready and eager to help. There's Francis Langill of the Rockin' Bee, John Croydon of the Piano Ranch, Henry Wertner, who's the barony's stockliner as well as a horse breeder in his own right, Hash Renfrew, who owns the Lazy Susan, the biggest horse ranch in Magus, not that it's much by the standards you fellas are used to, I wot, and there'll be others as well. Rhymer'll introduce you and get you about your business right smart."
Roland nodded and turned to Cuthbert. "You'll want to be on your mettle tomorrow night?" Cuthbert nodded.
"Don't fear me, Will. I'll note 'em all."
Avery sipped more tea, eyeing them over his glass with a roguish expression so false it made Roland want to squirm.
"Most of 'em's got daughters of marriageable age, and they'll bring 'em. You boys want to look out."
Roland decided he'd had enough tea and hypocrisy for one morning. He nodded, emptied his glass, smiled, hoping his look more genuine than Avery's now looked to him, and got to his feet. Cuthbert and Alain took the cue and did likewise.
"Thank you for the tea and for the welcome," Roland said. "Please send a message to Mayor Thorin, thanking him for his kindness, and telling him that he'll see us tomorrow at 8 o'clock prompt."
"Aye, so I will."
Roland then turned to Dave. That worthy was so surprised to be noticed again that he recoiled, almost bumping his head on the notice board.
"And please thank your wife for the tea. It was wonderful."
"I will. Thank you, Si."
They went back outside, High Sheriff Avery herding them along like a genial, overweight sheepdog.
"As to where you'll locate," he began as they descended the steps and started down the walk.
As soon as they hit the sunshine, he began to sweat.
"Oh, land, I forgot to ask you about that," Roland said, knocking the heel of his hand against his forehead. "We've camped out on that long slope. Lots of horses as you go down the turf. I'm sure you know where I mean."
"The drop, aye."
"But without permission, because we don't yet know who to ask."
"That'd be John Croydon's land, and I'm sure he wouldn't begrudge ye, but we mean to do you better than that. There's a spread northwest of here, the Bar K. Used to belong to the Garber family, but they gave it up and moved on after a fire. Now, it belongs to the Horsemen's Association. That's a little local group of farmers and ranchers. I spoke to Francis Langle about you fellas. He's the H.A. president, just current. And he said we'll put him out to the old Garber place. Why not?"
"Why not?" Cuthbert agreed in a gentle, musing voice. Roland shot him a sharp glance, but Cuthbert was looking down at the harbor, where the small fishing boats skittered to and fro like water bugs.
"Ah, just what I said. Why not indeed," I said. "The home place burned to a cinder, but the bunkhouse still stands. So does the stable and the cook shack next door to it. On Mayor Thorin's orders, I've taken the liberty of stocking the larder and having the bunkhouse swept out and spruced up a little. You may see the occasional bug, but nothing that'll bite or sting. And no snakes, unless there's a few under the floor. And if there are, let 'em stay there, is what I say. Hey, boys, let 'em stay there."
"Let 'em stay there, right under the floor, where they're happy,"
Cuthbert agreed, still gazing down at the harbor with his arms folded over his chest. Avery gave him a brief, uncertain glance, his smile flickering a bit at the corners. Then he turned back to Roland, and the smile shone out strongly once more.
"There's no holes in the roof, lad, and if it rains, you'll be dry. What think ye of that? Does it sound well to ye?"
"Better than we deserve. I think that you've been very efficient, and Mayor Thorin's been far too kind."
And he did think that. The question was, why?
"But we appreciate his thoughtfulness, don't we, boys?"
Cuthbert and Alain made vigorous assent.
"And we accept with thanks."
Avery nodded.
"I'll tell him. Go safely, boys."
They had reached the hitching rail. Avery once more shook hands all around, this time saving his keenest looks for their horses.
"Until tomorrow night, then, young gents?"
"Tomorrow night," Roland agreed.
"Will ye be able to find the barquet on your own, do you think?"
Again Roland was struck by the man's unspoken contempt and unconscious condescension. Yet perhaps it was to the good. If the High Sheriff thought they were stupid, who knew what might come of it?
"We'll find it," Cuthbert said, mounting up.
Avery was looking suspiciously at the rook's skull on the horn of Cuthbert's saddle. Cuthbert saw him looking, but for once managed to keep his mouth shut. Roland was both amazed and pleased by this unexpected reticence.
"Fare you well, Sheriff."
"And you, boy?"
He stood there by the hitching post, a large man in a khaki shirt with sweat stains around the armpits and black boots that looked too shiny for a working sheriff's feet. And where's the horse that could support him through a day of range riding, Roland thought. I'd like to see the cut of that cayuse. Avery waved to them as they went. The other deputies came down the walk, Deputy Dave in the forefront. They waved, too. 3. The moment the affiliation brats mounted on their father's expensive horse flesh were around the corner and headed downhill to the high street, the sheriff and the deputy stopped waving. Avery turned to Dave Hollis, whose expression of slightly stupid awe had been replaced by one marginally more intelligent.
"What thank you, Dave?"
Dave lifted his monocle to his mouth and began to nibble nervously at its brass edging, a habit about which Sheriff Avery had long since ceased to nag him. Even Dave's wife, Judy, had given up on that score, and Judy Hollis, Judy Wertner, that was a fair engine when it came to getting her own way.
Soft, Dave said. Soft as eggs just dropped out of a chicken's ass.
Mayhap, Avery said, putting his thumbs in his belt and rocking enormously back and forth.
But the one did most of the talking, him in the flathead hat, he doesn't think he's soft.
Don't matter what he thinks, Dave said, still nibbling at his eyeglass.
He's in Hambry now. He may have to change his way of thinking to Arn.
Behind him, the other deputies laughed. Even Avery smiled. They would leave the rich boys alone if the rich boys left them alone. Those were orders, straight from Mayor's house. But Avery had to admit that he wouldn't mind a little dust-up with them, so he wouldn't. He would enjoy putting his boot into the balls of the one with that idiotic bird skull on his saddle horn, standing there and mocking him, he'd been, thinking all the while that Herc Avery was too country-dumb to know what he was up to. But the thing he'd really enjoy would be beating the cool look from the eyes of the boy in the flat-head preacher's hat, seeing a hotter expression of fear rise up in them, as Mr. Will Dearborn of Hemp Hill realized that New Canaan was far away and his rich father couldn't help him.
"Aye," he said, clapping Dave on the shoulder, "mayhap he'll have to change his way of thinking."
He smiled, one very different from any of those he had shown the affiliation counters.
"Mayhap they all will."
Four. The three boys rode in single file until they were past the Traveler's Rest. A young and obviously retarded man with kinky black hair looked up from scrubbing the brick stoop and waved to them. They waved back. Then they moved up abreast, Roland in the middle.
"What did you think of our new friend, the High Sheriff?" Roland asked.
"I have no opinion," Cuthbert said brightly. "Nope, none at all.
Opinion is politics, and politics is an evil which has caused many a fellow to be hung while he's still young and pretty." He leaned forward and tapped the rook's skull with his knuckles.
"The lookout didn't care for him, though. I'm sorry to say that our faithful lookout thought Sheriff Avery a fat bag of guts without a trustworthy bone in his body."
Roland turned to Alain. "And you, young Master Stockworth?" Alain considered it for some time, as was his way, chewing a piece of grass he'd bent over saddle to pluck from his side of the road. At last he said, "If he came upon us burning in the street, I don't think he'd piss on us to put us out."
Cuthbert laughed heartily at that.
"And you will? How do you say, dear Captain?"
"He doesn't interest me much. But one thing he said does. Given that the horse meadow they call the Drop has to be at least 30 wheels long and runs 5 or more to the dusty desert, how do you suppose Sheriff Avery knew we were on the part of it that belongs to Croydon's piano ranch?"
They looked at him, first with surprise, then speculation. After a moment, Cuthbert leaned forward and rapped once more on the rook's skull.
"We're being watched, and you never reported it? No supper for you, sir. And it'll be the stockade the next time it happens."
But before they had gone much farther, Roland's thoughts of Sheriff Avery gave way to more pleasant ones of Susan Delgado. He would see her the following night. Of that he was sure. He wondered if her hair would be down. He couldn't wait to find out.
5.
Now here they were, at Mayor's house. Let the game begin, Roland thought, not clear on what that meant, even as the phrase went through his mind, surely not thinking of castles. Not then. The hostlers led their mounts away, and for a moment the three of them stood at the foot of the steps, huddled, almost, as horses do in unfriendly weather, their beardless faces washed by the light of the torches. From inside the guitars played, and voices were raised in a fresh eddy of laughter.
"Do we knock?" Cuthbert asked. "Or just open and march in?"
Roland was spared answering. The main door of the hussy was thrown open, and two women stepped out, both wearing long white-collared dresses that reminded all three boys of the dresses stockmen's wives wore in their own part of the world. Their hair was caught back in snoods that sparkled with some bright diamondy stuff in the light of the torches.
The plumper of the two stepped forward, smiling, and dropped them a deep curtsy. Her earrings, which looked like square-cut fire dims, flashed and bobbed.
"You are the young men from the affiliation, so you are, and welcome you are as well. Good even, sirs, and may your days be long upon the earth."
They bowed in unison, boots forward, and thanked her in an unintended chorus that made her laugh and clap her hands. The tall woman beside her offered them a smile as spare as her frame.
"I am Olive Thorin," the plump woman said, "the mayor's wife. This is my sister-in-law, Carl."
Carl Thorin, still with that narrow smile that barely creased her lips and touched her eyes not at all, dipped them a token curtsy. Roland, Cuthbert, and Alan bowed again over their outstretched legs.
"I welcome you to seafront," Olive Thorin said, her dignity leavened and made pleasant by her artless smile, her obvious dazzlement at the appearance of her young visitors from Inworld. "Come to our house with joy, I say so with all my heart, so I do."
"And so we will, madam," Roland said, "for your greeting has made us joyful." He took her hand, and with no calculation whatever, raised it to his lips and kissed it. Her delighted laughter made him smile. He liked Olive Thorin on sight, and it was perhaps well he met someone of that sort early on, for with the problematic exception of Susan Delgado, he met no one else he liked, no one else he trusted, all that night. 6. It was warm enough, even with the sea breeze, and a cloak and coat collector in the foyer looked as though he'd had little or no custom. Roland wasn't entirely surprised to see that it was Deputy Dave, his remaining bits of hair slicked back with some sort of gleaming grease, and his monocle now lying on the snow-white breast of a houseman's jacket. Roland gave him a nod. Dave, his hands clasped behind his back, returned it. Two men, Sheriff Avery and an elderly gent as gaunt as old Dr. Death in a cartoon, came toward them. Beyond, through a pair of double doors now open wide, a whole room full of people stood about with crystal punch cups in their hands, talking and taking little bits of food from the trays which were circulating. Roland had time for just one narrow-eyed glance toward Cuthbert. Everything, every name, every face, every nuance, especially those. Cuthbert raised an eyebrow, his discreet version of a nod, and then Roland was pulled willy-nilly into the evening, his first real evening of service as a working gunslinger, and he had rarely worked harder. Old Dr. Death turned out to be Kimba Reimer, Thorin's chancellor and minister of inventory. Roland suspected the title had been made up special for their visit. He was easily 5 inches taller than Roland, who was considered tall in Gilead, and his skin was pale as candle wax. Not unhealthy-looking, just pale. Wings of iron-gray hair floated away from either side of his head, gossamer as cobwebs. The top of his skull was completely bald. Balanced on his whelk of a nose was a pince-nez. "My boys," he said when the introductions had been made. He had the smooth, sadly sincere voice of a politician or an undertaker. "Welcome to Mages, to Hambry, and to Seafront, our humble mayor's house."
"If this is humble, I should wonder at the palace your folk might build," Roland said. It was a mild enough remark, more pleasantry than witticism. He ordinarily left the wit to Bert. But Chancellor Reimer laughed hard. So did Sheriff Avery.
"Come, boys," Reimer said, when he apparently felt he had expressed enough amusement. "The mayor awaits you with impatience, I'm sure."
"Aye,"
said a timid voice from behind them. The skinny sister-in-law, Coral, had disappeared, but Olive Thorin was still there, looking up at the newcomers with her hands decorously clasped before that area of her body which might once have been her waist. She was still smiling her hopeful, pleasant smile.
"Very eager to meet you, heart is. Very eager indeed.
Shall I conduct them, Kimba?" "Nay, nay, you mustn't trouble yourself with so many other guests to attend," Reimer said.
"I suppose you're right."
She curtsied to Roland and his companions a final time. And although she still smiled, and although the smile looked completely genuine to Roland,
He thought, she's unhappy about something all the same. Desperately so, I think.
Gentlemen, Reimer asked. The teeth in his smile were almost disconcertingly huge. Will ye come? He led them past the grinning sheriff and into the reception hall. Seven.
Roland was hardly overwhelmed by it. He had, after all, been in the Great Hall of Gilead, the Hall of the Grandfathers, it was sometimes called, and had even peeped down on the great party which was held there each year, the so-called Dance of Easterling, which marked the end of Wide Earth and the advent of sowing. There were 5 chandeliers in the Great Hall instead of just 1, and lit with electric bulbs rather than oil lamps. The dress of the partygoers, many of them expensive young men and women who had never done a hand's turn of work in their lives, a fact of which John Farson spoke at every opportunity, had been richer, the music had been fuller, the company of older and nobler lines which grew closer and closer together as they stretched back toward Arthur Eld, he of the white horse and unifying sword. Yet there was life here, and plenty of it. There was a robustness that had been missing in Gilead, and not just at Easterling either. The texture he felt as he stepped into the mayor's house reception room was the sort of thing, Roland reflected, that you didn't entirely miss when it was gone, because it slipped away quietly and painlessly, like blood from a vein cut in a tub filled with hot water. The room, almost, but not quite grand enough to be a hall, was circular, its paneled walls decorated by paintings, most quite bad, of previous mayors. On a raised stand to the right of the doors leading into the dining area, 4 grinning guitarists in toddy jackets and sombreros were playing something that sounded like a waltz with pepper on it. In the center of the floor was a table supporting 2 cut-glass punch bowls, one vast and grand, the other smaller and plainer. The white-jacketed fellow in charge of the dipping-out operations was another of Avery's deputies. Contrary to what the High Sheriff had told them the day before, several of the men were wearing sashes of various colors, but Roland didn't feel too out of place in his white silk shirt, black string tie, and 1 pair of stovepipe dress trousers. For every man wearing a sash, he saw 3 wearing the sort of dowdy, box-tailed coats that he associated with stockmen at church, and he saw several others, younger men for the most part, who weren't wearing coats at all. Some of the women wore jewelry, though nothing so expensive as Cy Thorin's fire-dim earrings, and few looked as if they'd missed many meals, but they also wore clothes Roland recognized. The long, round-collared dresses, usually with the lace fringe of a colored underskirt showing below the hem, the dark shoes with low heels, the snoods, most sparkling with gem dust, as those of Olive and Coral Thorin had been. And then he saw one who was very different. It was Susan Delgado, of course, shimmering and almost too beautiful to look at, in a blue silk dress with a high waist and a square-cut bodice which showed the tops of her breasts. Around her neck was a sapphire pendant that made Olive Thorin's earrings look like paste. She stood next to a man wearing a sash the color of coals in a hot wood fire. That deep orange-red was the barony's color, and Roland supposed that the man was their host. But for the moment Roland barely saw him. His eye was held by Susan Delgado. The blue dress, the tan skin, the triangles of color, too pale and perfect to be makeup, which ran lightly up her cheeks, most of all her hair, which was unbound tonight and fell to her waist like a shimmer of palest silk. He wanted her, suddenly and completely, with a desperate depth of feeling that felt like sickness. Everything he was and everything he had come for, it seemed, was secondary to her. She turned a little then and spied him. Her eyes, they were gray, he saw, widened the tiniest bit. He thought that the color in her cheeks deepened a little. Her lips, lips that had touched his as they stood on a dark road, he thought, with wonder, parted a little. Then the man standing next to Thorin, also tall, also skinny, with a mustache and long white hair lying on the dark shoulders of his coat, said something, and she turned back to him. A moment later, the group around Thorin was laughing, Susan included. The man with the white hair didn't join them, but smiled thinly. Roland, hoping his face did not give away the fact that his heart was pounding like a hammer, was led directly to this group, which stood close to the punch bowls. Distantly, he could feel Reimer's bony confederation of fingers clamped to his arm above the elbow. More clearly, he could smell mingled perfumes, the oil from the lamps on the walls, the aroma of the ocean, and thought for no reason at all, "Oh, I am dying, I am dying." "Take hold of yourself, Roland of Gilead. Stop this foolishness for your father's sake. Take hold." He tried, to some degree succeeded, and knew he would be lost the next time she looked at him. It was her eyes. The other night, in the dark, he hadn't been able to see those fog-colored eyes. "I didn't know how lucky I was," he thought wryly. "Mayor Thorin," Reimer asked, "may I present our guests from the inner baronies?" Thorin turned away from the man with the long white hair and the woman standing next to him, his face brightening. He was shorter than his chancellor, but just as thin, and his build was peculiar, a short and narrow-shouldered upper body over impossibly long and skinny legs. He looked, Roland thought, like the sort of bird you should glimpse in a marsh at dawn, bobbing for its breakfast.
"Aye, you may!" he cried in a strong, high voice. "Indeed you may. We've been waiting with impatience, great impatience, for this moment. Well met we are, very well met. Welcome, sirs. May your evening in this house of which I am the fleeting proprietor be happy, and may your days be long upon the earth."
Roland took the bony, outstretched hand, heard the knuckles crack beneath his grip, looked for an expression of discomfort on the mayor's face, and was relieved to see none. He bowed low over his outstretched leg. "William Dearborn, Mayor Thorin, at your service. Thank you for your welcome, and may your own days be long upon the earth." Arthur Heath made his manners next, then Richard Stockworth. Thorin's smile widened at each deep bow. Reimer did his best to beam, but looked unused to it. The man with the long white hair took a glass of punch, passed it to his female companion, and continued to smile thinly. Roland was aware that everyone in the room, the guests numbered perhaps 50 in all, was looking at them, but what he felt most upon his skin, beating like a soft wing, was her regard. He could see the blue silk of her dress from the side of one eye, but did not dare look at her more directly.
"Was your trip difficult?" Thorin was asking. "Did you have adventures and experience perils? We would hear all the details at dinner, so we would, for we have few guests from the inner ark these days."
His eager, slightly fatuous smile faded, his tufted brows drew together.
"Did you encounter patrols of Farson?"
"No, Excellency." Roland said.
"Nay, lad, nay. No, Excellency, I won't have it, and the fisherfolk and Hostrovers I serve wouldn't, even if I would. Just Mayor Thorin, if you please."
"Thank you. We saw many strange things on our journey, Mayor Thorin, but no good men."
"Good men?"
Reimer jerked out, and his upper lip lifted in a smile which made him look dog-like.
"Good men, indeed." "We would hear it all, every word," Thorin said. "But before I forget my manners and my eagerness, young gentlemen, let me introduce you to those close around me. Kimba, you've met. This formidable fellow to my left is Eldred Jonas, chief of my newly installed security staff."
Thorin's smile looked momentarily embarrassed.
"I'm not convinced that I need extra security. Sheriff Avery's always been quiet enough to keep the peace in our corner of the world, but Kimba insists. And when Kimba insists, the mayor must bow."
"Very wise, sir," Reimer said, and bowed himself. They all laughed, save for Jonas, who simply held on to his narrow smile. Jonas nodded.
"Please, gents, I'm sure."
The voice was a reedy quaver. He then wished them long days upon the earth, all three, coming to Roland last in his round of handshaking. His grip was dry and firm, utterly untouched by the tremor in his voice. And now Roland noticed the queer blue shape tattooed on the back of the man's right hand, in the webbing between thumb and first finger. It looked like a coffin. "Long days, pleasant nights," Roland said, with hardly a thought. It was a greeting from his childhood, and it was only later that he would realize it was one more apt to be associated with Gilead than with any such rural place as Hemphill. Just a small slip, but he was beginning to believe that their margin for such slips might be a good deal less than his father had thought when he had sent Roland here to get him out of Martin's way. "And to you," Jonas said. His bright eyes measured Roland with a thoroughness that was close to insolence, still holding his hand. Then he released it and stepped back.
"Cordelia Delgado," Mayor Thorin said,
next bowing to the woman who had been speaking to Jonas. As Roland also bowed in her direction, he saw the family resemblance, except that what looked generous and lovely on Susan's face looked pinched and folded on the face before him now. Not the girl's mother. Roland guessed that Cordelia Delgado was a bit too young for that.
"And our especial friend, Miss Susan Delgado," Thorin finished, sounding flustered.
Roland supposed she would have that effect on any man, even an old one like the mayor. Thorin urged her forward, bobbing his head and grinning, one of his knuckle-choked hands pressed against the small of her back, and Roland felt an instant of poisonous jealousy. Ridiculous, given this man's age and his plump, pleasant wife. But it was there, all right, and it was sharp. Sharp as a bee's ass, Court would have said. Then her face tilted up to his, and he was looking into her eyes again. He had heard of drowning in a woman's eyes in some poem or story, and thought it ridiculous. He still thought it ridiculous, but understood it was perfectly possible, nonetheless. And she knew it. He saw concern in her eyes, perhaps even fear.
"Promise me that if we meet at Mayor's house, we meet for the first time."
The memory of those words had a sobering, clarifying effect, and seemed to widen his vision a little. Enough for him to be aware that the woman beside Jonas, the one who shared some of Susan's features, was looking at the girl with a mixture of curiosity and alarm. He bowed low, but did little more than touch her ringless, outstretched hand. Even so, he felt something like a spark jump between their fingers. From the momentary widening of those eyes, he thought that she felt it too. "Pleased to meet you, Si," he said. His attempt to be casual sounded tinny and false in his own ears. Still, he was begun. It felt like the whole world was watching him, them, and there was nothing to do but go on with it. He tapped his throat 3 times.
"May your days be long, aye, and yours, Mr. Dearborn. Thank you, Si."
She turned to Elaine with a rapidity that was almost rude, then to Cuthbert, who bowed, tapped, then said gravely,
"Might I recline briefly at your feet, miss? Your beauty has loosened my knees. I'm sure a few moments spent looking up at your profile from below with the back of my head on these cool tiles would put me right."
They all laughed at that, even Jonas and Miss Cordelia. Susan blushed prettily and slapped the back of Cuthbert's hand. For once Roland blessed his friend's relentless sense of foolery. Another man joined the party by the punch bowl. This newcomer was blocky and blessedly unthin in his boxtail coat. His cheeks burned with high color that looked like windburn rather than drink, and his pale eyes lay in nets of wrinkles. A rancher, Roland had ridden often enough with his father to know the look.
"There'll be maids aplenty to meet you boys tonight," the newcomer said with a friendly enough smile. "You'll find yourselves drunk on perfume if you're not careful. But I'd like my crack at you before you meet him. Friend Lingle, at your service."
His grip was strong and quick. No bowing or other nonsense went with it.
"I own the Rocking Bee, or it owns me, whichever way you want to look at it. I'm also boss of the Horsemen's Association, at least till they fire me. The barquet was my idea. Hope it's all right?"
"It's perfect, sir," Alan said. "Clean and dry and room for 20. Thank you, you've been too kind."
"Nonsense," Langle said, looking pleased all the same as he knocked back a glass of punch.
We're all in this together, boy. John Farson's but one bad straw in a field of wrong-headedness these days. The world's moved on, folks say. Huh, so it has, aye, and a good piece down the road to hell is where it's moved on, too. Our job is to hold the hay out of the furnace as well as we can, as long as we can. For the sake of our children, even more than for that of our fathers.
Hear, hear,
Mayor Thorin said in a voice that strove for the high ground of solemnity and fell with a splash into fatuity instead. Roland noted the scrawny old fellow was gripping one of Susan's hands. She seemed almost unaware of it, was looking intently at Langill instead. And suddenly he understood. The mayor was either her uncle or perhaps a cousin of some close degree. Langill ignored both, looking at the three newcomers instead, scrutinizing each in turn, and finishing with Roland.
"Anything us and Magus can do to help, lad, just ask. Me, John Croydon, Hash Renfrew, Jake White, Hank Wertner, any or all. You'll meet 'em tonight, aye, their wives and sons and daughters as well, and you need only ask. We may be a good piece out from the hub of New Canaan here, but we're strong for the affiliation all the same, aye, very strong."
"Well spoken," Rhymer said quietly.
"And now," Langill said, "we'll toast your arrival proper. And you've had to wait too long already for a dip of punch. It's dry as dust you must be."
He turned to the punch bowls and reached for the ladle and the larger and more ornate of the two, waving off the attendant, clearly wanting to honor them by serving them himself. "Mr. Langill," Roland said quietly. Yet there was a force of command in that voice. Fran Langill heard it and turned. "The smaller bowl is soft punch, is it not?" Langill considered this